Matt Chastain, welcome to the Homilist Podcast, buddy.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, listen, I want you to know I was on a phone call with a buddy of mine just a minute ago, and I said, yeah, I got a podcast interview in a little bit. And he goes, oh, yeah. I said, a guy named Matt Chastain. He said, how'd you get a hold of Matt Chastain? And I was like, well, I looked up his IMDb page, and then I looked for some other information, and I found an organization he was connected to, and then I emailed that organization. And he's like, what movie were you watching? And I was like, this dude is a Matt Chastain fan. So I've known this guy my whole life. And he's like, how'd you get a hold of him? What movie?
He's hard to get a hold of. He's almost 600 followers on Twitter. He's huge.
Isn't that awesome? I thought that was so cool.
Well, tell your friend to feel free to reach out any way he wants.
I thought it was cool,
man. Not hard to find.
I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Just don't tell the government. Hide from them.
Listen, yeah, well, listen, we had plenty of conversations about that.
So that may divide our audience in two, but that's all right. Let's do it. Whatever.
I'm all about contention. So I'm flipping through Amazon Prime the other day, and I see this movie, and it's a Christian film. And I do what any normal pastor does. I think to myself,
ignore it. Not gonna watch that.
Please, not another Christian film.
Not another one of those.
And so then I get to looking and I read through it. It's like the description's awesome. Then I turn the trailer on. I'm halfway through the trailer. I'm like, crap, I'm actually gonna watch this film. Then I start it. And then halfway through, I'm like, I'm Googling you. Like I'm going. I'm like, where do I find this cat? Like, who? I'm like, number one, who's this actor? Where did this film come from? And then come to find out, you're the writer, you're an actor in it, you're the director of this film called Small Group that came out in 2018.
That's right.
Man, I completely not on my radar. Of course, I'm not perusing Christian films looking for it, but man, knocked it out of the park.
Thank you.
Knocked it out of the park. Tell me a little bit about this film.
Oh, that's a pretty open-ended question. Hope you got some Joe Rogan time for your podcast.
All the time we
one
need.
One of those that you can kick back and relax now. It's going to go a while.
That's right.
Man, you know, the story goes back almost 10 years now because in 14, my wife and I, we had both grown up in kind of little small Baptist churches and kind of got away from church in the college in the 20s. And then we get married and it's time, you know, we should probably go back to church. It's not an uncommon thing, right? We need to get back to our Christian faith, our Christian roots. The world's falling apart. Even we thought it was falling apart back then. Oh, what little did we know. But anyway, we try a bunch of churches out and it seems like all of our friends were in small groups. I remember this one guy's like, like, we kept trying to get him to go play softball with the JCs on Tuesday nights. He's like, oh, I can't do it. I got the small group. Okay, whatever. What is a small group? And so we went to this one new church, Watkinsville First Baptist Church. And a church had grown big enough to, you know, when churches get to a certain size, they have to go to the small group model, right? And so I was like, okay, I'll give this thing a shot. We tried one group, and it was like, yeah, I like these people, but it's probably not a good fit. They've all been best friends for 9 years, and it's going to take a long time for us to kind of ease into that and be as close and not feel like an outsider. And then we were volunteering at VBS, and I was just kind of one of those guys. They said, you just be there for somebody who needs you. So this one guy comes up to me. He's got an arm in a sling. He owns a roofing company. A guy had fallen off a roof and he had tried to catch him, ripped his bicep apart. So he's in this. He's like, you're going to be my hands. Okay, cool. And this guy was freaking hilarious. And this guy was the most dry-witted, just said inappropriate things. Not so inappropriate that he'd get kicked out of the Baptist church, but inappropriate enough to where, you know, this is one of my people.
Sure.
So we had a great time at VBS. He calls me a couple weeks later. He's like, hey, listen, you're going to be my small group. Okay, what? He's like, we had a small group, six families, six couples. We split three and three, and each couple's responsible for going to recruit a new couple, so we're recruiting you. Okay, cool. Never been in a, and hadn't really been a part of a small group, but I think I'd only kind of visited them. So we went, and I was, you know, when the first few meetings, I'm like, this is in 2014. I'm like, this is kind of cool, because, you know, the one thing I always kind of have a natural, attraction to, or it's even a bigger word than that, is just kind of genuine. I like to I don't like to feel like I'm in a situation where everybody's trying to be something that they're not. I like real and honest. And so I would rather hear somebody, you know, cut a fart joke in Sunday school than be overly, you know, a version of themselves that's just too sanitized, because that doesn't feel real to me. But this didn't feel sanitized. It felt like we were actually pursuing God. We're studying the Bible, but we're not sanitized in the way we do it. When I'm not saying we're promoting sin, I'm just saying, like,
right,
we're not trying to be too sanitized, and it is authenticity is what I'm all about. Yep. So we are we're in this group, and I'm thinking, you know, somebody ought to do it. There's all these Christian movies coming out right now, and they're mostly pretty terrible from what I can tell. But if somebody could do a movie called Small Group, that's a, and I think they're terrible because it's a reflection of the somewhat inauthentic, sanitized versions of ourselves, right? These movies are just very preachy and expositional. They don't feel real because they're not intended to be a real story. They're just the thinnest layer of story, with the underneath of that crust being sermon, right? They're just preachy. Right. They're expositional. And anybody in the film business knows exposition is the sin in our business. I mean, even Jesus said it. Tell them stories. Tell them fables. Tell them. My thought was this would be a great environment for good storytelling within a Christian message, because it allows – because it is just so naturally less sanitized and more real. It seemed also to be a little more biblical, because Jesus himself, he never pursued a crowd. The crowd pursued him. Right. He pursued the 12. Okay. The first thing he did in his ministry, he went and got himself a small group.
Yeah.
Literally. So I thought, okay, it's clearly biblical, because Jesus did it first. It was his first thing he did in his ministry.
Right.
I mean, and besides, you know, some of the conversations when he was a kid at the with the rabbis. But the first main thing he did was go and get himself a small group. So I was like, okay, this is going to be good. So I went to a producer of mine. I owned a marketing company, and I was creative director and production director. So I shot TV commercials and internet video for a living. But I had never done film. I had the chance to do film because back in college, I'll reverse a little bit. Back in college, I was part of a sketch comedy troupe. And thank God this was before YouTube. It was just before YouTube, because it was, like I said, I was not even close to pursuing anything close to Christianity at that point. It was very raw comedy. And my two partners were like, well, we got picked up on college dorm campuses everywhere. The show had to be renamed, but it went on MTV2 for a season. And at that point, you know, my partner's like, we're going to LA, we're chasing this thing. And I'm like, you know, there's something about Los Angeles, and I just think I need to grow up and not do this kind of toilet humor anymore. I'm gonna stay without it. So I just always thought, I'm not gonna pursue the film business, because the film business is just, I mean, it is what it is, you know. I mean, Harvey Weinstein was not an anomaly. That the business has been taken over by your very, very, very corrupt power seekers.
Yeah.
And so I stayed here, got into the marketing field. So I'm in the marketing field, and I'm sitting. I went to have a meeting with a buddy of mine who, well, was working for a company, but he was also a film producer on the side. If you're in Athens, Georgia, we are, and you're going to pursue, you know, a short or film, you go talk to Chris Hines, because Chris Hines knows everybody. Chris Hines is just one of the most beloved and liked and respected dudes in this area. Still is to this day. He's still doing independent film. So I went to him and I said, I got a good idea for you, Chris. And I thought this idea was going to help me sell him on the commercial for his business, which was something totally separate. I said, I'm going to give you this just kind of as an added bonus. I was like, you should do a faith-based film called Small Group. And he's like, you know, my wife and I have been in several small groups over at Athens Church. That's brilliant. And I was like, haha, I got him. And I thought I was just going to give him the idea and walk away. He goes, go write it. Huh? You want what? Write it? I never wrote no movie film before. He goes, just try. So I was like, okay, cool. So part of the reason the premise is good, I believe, is because of my ignorance, right? I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I'd taken screenwriting classes in college and did pretty well in them, but I purposely forgot all of that because I don't want anybody telling me what to do. But so I was like, okay, I can write it. I mean, you know, young 30-something. Sure. I was actually about 37 at the time, arrogant. 36, 35, I don't know. It was a long time ago. And I was like, yeah, I can do this. I can write something way better than all that crap out there. So I wrote a first draft, and it was terrible, really, really, really bad. I would never let anybody read the first draft. It was awful. It had some moments. There are actually a few scenes that you saw in the movie that survived almost intact from that first draft. So what Chris said, all right, look, there's a guy who just moved to town. He came into town to write a book, but he met with us at the local film meeting group, whatever. And this guy came from L.A. He spent the last 20 years in L.A., and his specialty is development of writers, not development of scripts, not co-writing, developing writers. He's like, I want to bring him in and I want you to do whatever he wants you to do. I was like, okay, cool. So I met this guy named Dale Wheatley, fascinating guy, not a believer himself, but just a wonderfully good-hearted person. But his specialty was script development. I mean, he did his first movie 30 years ago, almost, with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. It's a movie that nobody's ever seen because there was some fighting going on between them, but I've seen it. It's one of those 90s independent movies, and it would have been amazing, but, he and Tobey kind of did this. And so Tobey ruined his career, and then he himself couldn't now be a director or an actor. He had to go develop others. So couldn't do it in LA because of the blacklist by Tobey. Leo DiCaprio. And so he moved here. So we started working together. And here was the process. He would read my draft, and he would just spend like 30 hours taking notes. And it can be just anything and everything, from small little misspelled word here or too many spaces here. But more often it was more about, okay, you know, this character, I have an issue with this character. This character seems like it could be deeper here. We got to get you on the right structure here. And so we just take notes. And then he and I would get together at a coffee shop, usually on a Sunday afternoon after church, and we would just sit there for 8 hours. And we would just have a therapy session on the script. We'd just start talking through it. He would never hand me his notes. He would always just talk. We'd talk through them. So yeah. It was, like I said, 8 hours for one draft. And I would be typing my notes on my computer at the time. Then I would sit down, open the current draft, open his notes, and go address each one. Now, a lot of the things he would do is he would say, there's an issue here with this thing, and I suggest this. Maybe, you know, I was stubborn, so maybe 80% of the time I'd be like, I don't like your suggestion, but I'll come up with something better. And it would work. It would help me come up with something better. But you know, a lot of the times his suggestions would be great. One example, the character Billy, who everybody loves, the character Billy in Small Group. He's the neighbor across the street, big, loud country boy. I was just with that actor last week, actually. He came through town, and I got to have breakfast with him. But anyway, the character Billy, I needed to have my protagonist needed to have a neighbor who he kind of judged, because the protagonist is this is a independent filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, who's been charged with kind of infiltrating a church's small group to kind of judge them, right? To see what are Christians like when they don't think the cameras are on them. Yeah. And so his job is to kind of, and he's kind of turning his nose up at them a little bit at this point. But he meets Billy, and it gives him to somebody to judge. Well, Billy was going to be more of a Ned Flanders type character, kind of a super annoying Christian. And my guy was like, why don't you take the Christian part out, so we're not hitting that too heavy, and just give him somebody to judge, so he's not on the defensive about the same subject that he's been brought to Georgia to do. He said, you could be like a rocker, like, you know, like an 80s rocker, and he's always rocking out. And I was like, nope, he's just a big, loud redneck. He's going to be like
this guy.
Exactly, you know this guy. He's like all of my have my cousins.
Yeah.
Not that they're rednecks, but our family is loud. I'm loud. We're insistent, but we mean well. And so that's where Billy came from. So that's what we would do. So we did that. Like I said, it would take me another 2 months to then take his notes and do a new draft. And that's round one. We did that for 9 rounds. It took 18 months, and then we had a script. And then once the script is there, we spent 4 months. So I had a lot of business contacts, a lot of family, a lot of people who thought that I was, you know, capable of doing something cool. And so I went around for 9 months raising funds to make a movie, and we raised $1.1 million from January of 2016 through May or June of 2016. And brother, by August of 2016, well, from June to August, we're in pre-production. In August 2016, we start shooting, and the rest is history.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. Yeah, absolutely incredible. I was, you're right about Billy. Like, fascinating character, because when you meet him, you do the same thing that the protagonist does. The same exact thing that Cooper does in the film. You look at him, you're like, oh gosh, I freaking know this guy. Yep. Like, I know this guy. This is loud, obnoxious, always got a spit bottle in his hand, you know? I mean, but I told you, my favorite scene is when
spoilers, but Gary. Oh,
it's so great. When he starts in on the medical side, it's like, golly, it's well done. It's well written.
Redemption. I mean, that's the thing, is that there are redemptive qualities in everyone. Yeah. If we can forgive the qualities that annoy us, people will often find redemptive qualities. And that was the whole thing for Billy's character.
Yeah.
And it does. That moment, I love being in theaters when I would go to the theaters, watch it with people. And that there was a tension in the room at that point was created by all the other things going on. But then when Billy's kind of redemptive moment comes, everybody, you can just feel the energy of the room. Because like you say, if we did our job, they felt so annoyed by him. And then they themselves were a little convicted. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's not just, oh, Coop is it. No, it's you yourself are having this redemptive moment about Billy and having to forgive him yourself. And there's an energy in the room when that happens. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, storytelling really matters. I mean, that's what you were saying earlier. The storytelling really matters. Like that is the best way to convey any truth, is that when you can tell it in story. And what you've done with this is really good. I mean, it was super, because and I think I told you this in an email, it's so self-aware. Like the film is so self-aware. Like, we know where we're douchey, we know where we're we're absolutely crystal clear on this. Like, it's we know these weird pockets of things that we do. I was at jiu-jitsu the other morning, and these two guys, I got a Catholic guy and a Baptist church guy, and they're always at each other's neck. One's the Catholic youth guy, one's a Baptist, the Baptist minister. So we're all in this jiu-jitsu. It's grown men. It's a grown
bunch
men.
Of pastors rolling around.
Barefooted. It's just awkward as it can be. And these two got in an argument about baptism, and which is hilarious, because you've got the Catholic standpoint on baptism. Then you've got this First Baptist Church guy on baptism, and they're trying to convince one another. And the Catholic guy's like, you don't even think baptism matters. And he's like, but you're sprinkling babies. Like, and they're just going, like, it was just really good. You know? So I just jumped right in the middle of it. And I said, hey, listen, both of you need to can it, because look, here's the deal. Like, it says, do it. Like, nobody gets into, start, splitting hairs on this and splitting hairs on that. And like, because here's the thing. That's not the weirdest thing we've got to contend with scripture. Like, we got a virgin birth. We got to figure out. There's so many.
How do you get out of that tomb? There's things.
There's so many other things that these guys
are
going
to. And then the Calvinist showed up and told you all why you're wrong.
That's exactly right. So anyway, it was one of those. It was a funny conversation. Of course, our teacher, our coach, we call him all kinds of things. We call him Kung Fu Carrie. We call him Master Splinter. We call him all kinds
Master
of stuff.
Master Splinter. That's way better than Sensei.
Yeah, way better. He's sitting over there, this just huge smile on his face. He's like, oh, this is awesome. Like, we might get a real fight today. Like, this is really cool. So this is awesome.
Get a real fight.
It was cool.
How that works, man. It's like, we have to be able to look at ourselves objectively. Mm-hmm. And because it's our job to reflect the gospel. If we're going to go ye therefore, we got to get the log out of our own eye first. And a lot of Christian films don't want to do that to that extent, right? And so my job was, I think the thing is, you can't start, you're talking about storytelling, you can't start with, I've got something I want to say. A lesson I mean, I've got a finger I'm going to wag at the world.
Right.
Doesn't work. You can't. You start by going, okay, let's find a question and a what would happen if question, and then explore it and be as real as possible every step of the way.
Yeah.
Like if you're exploring that's what I was doing when I was writing. What would happen if this guy, we got a documentary filmmaker, he wants to get inside the church. So there's a little tension there. That's cool. Cause he's undercover. He's fooling them. But the good part about that is he does get to see their real side of them.
Yeah.
What happens when he's exposed? How do they react? How does everybody react? And so I couldn't approach this film as to what I want to happen. I couldn't approach it as, everything works out perfectly in the end. And you know what I'm talking about? I had to approach it as what would happen, what does happen, what's likely to happen, and then just let the cards fall where they may. Mm-hmm. We can do that because the Bible itself is not sanitized for your protection. I always, I'm like, there's a lot. I have a huge problem with the Christian movie industry. It's just terrible. Yeah. There are a lot of wonderful people in it, but there are some unwritten rules in the Christian movie business, especially with you when you get the Pure Flicks and a lot of those there's got to be some redemption. They have these just certain rules of sanitization, I guess you would say,
sure,
that are beyond biblical. Okay, yeah. So for instance, if I went into Pure Flicks or any of the others and I said, all right, I'm going to pitch you guys a movie, okay, and this is going to be perfect. You're going to fund it. They're going to love it. It's about this woman. She's married. It's in a different culture. She unfortunately, her husband dies. It's very sad. Very sad. And in that culture, she can't inherit the money unless she's married, and she's going to be broke. So what does she do? She dresses up like a hooker, gets her father-in-law drunk, they have sex, they have a baby, and that baby is one of the descendants of Christ, you know, or one of the descendants, one of the ancestors of Christ. That they would kick me out of the room.
Yeah.
But that's a biblical story. The Bible doesn't even attempt to sanitize life like the Christian movie industry does. And the reason is the Christian movie industry only responds to the Christian movie audience. Unfortunately, if we train the audience to be a little more open to what what Christian movies and Christian art could be, the Christian movie industry would certainly react to that. Christian movie industry is just there to make money. That's it. They have a formula that works and they want to make money. And certainly our film did not fit that formula, which is why I think we won Best Picture at the International Christian Film Festival in 2019, because it was so different. It was so unique. But it makes it a little more challenging for most Christians, because they want it to fit a very specific mold. And I know I'm kind of giving Pure Flicks a hard time. Our movie's on Pure Flicks right now. Yeah. So I don't hate those guys. I'm just saying that standard, that whole standard of we've got to be more pure than the Bible, I think is where we're going wrong.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about it so often is you'll take a Christian audience who will be like, well, this is such a great film, you know, or you'll take Christian filmmakers who land in that place. And it's like, this is the thing we're trying to get across. We're going to wag our finger. Here's the preachy thing that we're going to say. We're going to do these things. It's like, if you were to bring in the story of Tamar and you were to lay that in front of these people and they would go, no, 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 no. Like, listen, that's not the worst movie you probably watched this month.
Right. You know? Yeah. You can't do that in a Christian.
I can't wait to see John Wick 4. But I loved Small Group. You know,
thank you.
I
mean, yeah. Hey, look, I'm a huge Tarantino fan. Me and my buddy, the pastor at the Baptist church, when one of his new movies comes out, we'll be texting each other, did you see it? It was glorious. It was amazing. Yeah, I mean, I don't need to sanitize the things I see to see humanity, you know, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't be so offended. Now, I'm not going to go out and put an excessive amount of vulgarity in my own movie, because I don't think I should live that way. But, you know, I there's not many Christian movies where the one of the main characters, my character, says, oh, hell no. That's one of my lines in the movie. Oh, hell no.
Which, by the way, when the main guy, Cooper, comes back in towards the end and he walks into the small group and everybody's there. This is my favorite scene of yours, where you were on absolute simmer. And I mean, you were standing and it's one of those scenes that just, you stay there to the point where it's like, dude, this dude looks mad. And then it stays just a hair longer to the point where I'm like, that's funny. Like, he's still mad. This dude is still mad. It was so good, man. You did a great job. You did a really great job.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're a good actor.
That actor, Sterling Hurst, this is, give you a funny story. I wasn't supposed to be in the movie. Okay. Sterling Hurst, who plays Scott Cooper, he was cast as my character, as Shane. Shane is the buddy, right? I knew I wanted a part of this movie to be a buddy comedy. And so Shane and Cooper are buddies. They bounce off each other real well. They're both super funny. But so what happened was we had another guy cast as Coop. I'm in Guatemala 6 weeks before we shoot, just kind of scouting and getting everything ready in Guatemala. Yeah. We get an email from the guy who's going to play the lead saying, oh, sorry, guys, I got this big Chevy commercial I've got to do. If you remember, there's a series of Chevy commercials where this guy's like leading focus groups or whatever, and he's always in front of some door that goes up. Anyway, it was this guy. And he tells us, I can't do the movie. And we're 6 weeks out. And so my producer, Dale Wheatley, is like, all right, well, you got a couple options. We can go back to the investors and say, we're going to have to push production indefinitely. Because we had looked at every actor. I mean, we'd looked at hundreds of actors for both Coop and Shane. I found nobody liked for Shane. I didn't even like Sterling for Shane because he's too nice. I wanted Shane to be a little more of what he is.
Yeah.
But we just couldn't find anybody we liked for Coop except for this one guy. And so he's like, we can go to the investors and we can tell them that we're going to have to push and start the casting process again. Likely some will go, you guys don't know what you're doing. Give me my money back. Or, Matt, you can play Shane. I'm like, what? Because I'd never done any real film acting before. I'd done a lot of acting in high school and that kind of thing. And I've been on camera all my life. But he's like, no, I think you can do it. And so, but part of the reason I was able to do the character is because of how, if you're not an actor, it's probably hard to see. But when you got actors like Sterling Hurst or like Nelson Bonilla, who played the missionary in Guatemala, you got actors like that you're working with, they can make you good because just being on screen with them. And Sterling Hurst was amazing in that role because it was actually a more challenging role than people think. Carrying a movie in general is a tough thing to do because you've got to be the tent poles that everybody else kind of hangs their talent on. And he did that. But then also being able to play in a movie like this that's both comedy and drama. I mean, I don't even like the term dramedy because a dramedy – it doesn't get real funny and it doesn't get real serious, but this movie is pretty funny and pretty silly at times. That he can hang with the silliness, but then it is incredibly dramatic at times, and he was able to do both of those things. And so it was funny because in that scene when I went up and I stared him down so hard, ready to kill him, he told me after, he's like, Matt, like, I was honestly afraid of you. And I'm like, Sterling, shut up. You are 3 inches taller than me and you work out like 8 hours a day in the gym. If we went into a tussle, it'd take you about 12 seconds to put me on my back.
Yeah. Well, it was great. I mean, he's right. I mean, because it's a vicious stare down. I'm like, dude, this dude's kind of wound up. And it was so good because it stayed to that point of like, this dude's going to skip all the social cues of everybody in the group and just going to stay mad right in his face. Everybody turns and he's still. And I thought, this guy. So, I mean, at this point, I'd already found some. C-Spark Go.
Funny. You found me at C-Spark Go. So yeah. So C-Spark Go is a PR agency who we hired to do some PR for the movie, owned by a guy who's been a friend for many, many, many years. After the movie, I kind of went in as kind of a contractor with them, and they'd bring me in on some jobs here and there. And so they just put me on their website. I was never a full-time employee of them, but they brought me in on some jobs to direct some video for them.
Yeah.
And I've been doing other things for the past couple of years. I forgot I was, on their website.
Yeah.
But that's funny. You found me through them because they're they're a big agency. And so I'm sure their SEO is better, but yeah, you found me through Caesar Go. Yeah. I know you sent in the email and they just sent it to me. They're like, Matt, I think they're looking for you. Head of the agency sent me that, so it
was, better not be the government.
Yeah, exactly. Andy knows; he knows how to filter that. So,
yeah. No, well, man, that was good of him. That was good of him to send it on over. I mean, oh, that's absolutely. That's something you get. You could lose that real quick and never even have to.
I'll talk about movies, especially the movie I made, anytime. It wasn't all good. The movie itself was great.
Yeah.
I hate to say that my experience with the movie was great. People who view the movie for the most part have a really good experience with it. So that part's good. The art part's good. The business side of it all was a complete and total disaster.
Really?
And so, yeah. Oh gosh, it's awful. It almost ruined my life. So, but I've gotten over it, I guess you could say, to the point now where it's not a bitter subject anymore. And I love talking about it. Not so much the business side of it, or I can go into that. It's kind of, there's some interesting things about it, but just the filmmaking side of it, the storytelling side of it, the acting and directing side of it, that stuff is, I did it once so far, hope to do it again, but those 6 weeks we were shooting, and then even in the 9 months of post-production after, were such an amazing blessing that if I never make another movie, I thank God that I got that opportunity, because I'm going to tell you, there's no better job in the world. Like you just feel like you're stealing money from somebody. Maybe we weren't really stealing. I'm just kidding. But no, you just feel like, how am I blessed enough to sit here and do this for a living?
Yeah, that's good.
Like cheating. I'm just playing.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you said something earlier that when it comes to making a film, when it comes to trying to get a point across, tell a story, and you set forward, you don't, when you were talking about like Christian organizations that want to try to make films, one of the things that for me that really matters, I mean, as a preacher, as somebody who like do a lot of writing, if it interests me and it lights me up, then what I want to do is I need to take that and run with it as far as I can run with it.
Yeah.
And what happens in that is like you bringing your idea to your guy and saying, hey, listen, I got an idea for a movie. Here it is. I think this would be awesome. And because it lit you up, it's going to move other people. You know, I've explained the process of sermon writing for me on Sundays is going into the woods, finding rocks and sticks and, you know, whatever it is, a pot, you know, stuff I'm mixing. I feel like I'm mixing something up and I'm trying to make fire.
You broke up a minute. You said you go into the woods and smoke pot.
Go into the woods, smoke a lot of pot.
You're a pastor.
That's right. That's right. So it's that idea, you know, it's that idea of go into and then to bring back some fire, bring back some smoldering ashes. And the way I feel is to stand before the congregation and say, I don't exactly know what this means. And I don't exactly know if this is all he is, but I think God looks kind of like this. Mm-hmm. And then to throw those sparks into the congregation. Like for me, that's that. And I know there's times where people walk out and they're like, I don't really know if I understand what that sermon was about, but it moved me. But I'm going to have to work out the details the rest of the week. You know,
That's what you want. You want to leave them with more questions, right? So that they want to go. It's the creative process. Writing a sermon, even though it's exposition, there's still a creative process. And the beauty, I don't know how any creative could also be an atheist. Agnostic maybe, but an atheist. Because you know as well as I do that there's a moment of inspiration.
100%.
And you know that idea did not come from you.
100%.
Now, they called it the muse, in Greek mythology, and it's called all kind of other things. Great book called The War of Art. Highly recommend it. But it's, you know, I'm not into drugs or alcohol or illicit behavior much. I mean, I like to have a craft beer as much as the next guy. But I'm addicted to the muse. I'm addicted to the inspiration that does not come from me, when ideas don't come from me. Mm-hmm. Because you know when you have an idea, you're just not as confident about it. You're like, I think I have an okay idea. Yeah. But when you can just open yourself up, and that's what creativity is for me, is the ability just to shut your stupid brain up long enough to be open to ideas that are given to you. For me, it's the shower. I go in the shower. I have to stand there. I have to have hot water that's 185 degrees. We have to get the burn kit out afterwards. I'm in there until it drains the entire tank. But every time, but the reason is for me is because that's the only place I can not be distracted. Mm-hmm. So when I'm in that alpha wave or whatever you want to call it, but that's when God's like, all right, now I got you. Now I have your attention. Mm-hmm. Here's an idea. And it can be an idea for a movie, or it can be an idea for a podcast. It can be an idea for, you know, something I'm supposed to do for my client at the Georgia Department of Human Resources. For me, what's cool about it is that it's the same level of excitement no matter what I'm doing it for. Even if it's a boring job I'm doing just to put food on the table, it still feels the same in its kind of pure form when you get that inspiration from God, regardless of the outcome, because you know that's what he wants me to do right now. Mm-hmm. And it's way easier for me to put my big loud mouth down and just head straight into doing something like the bull in a china shop I am, when I know deep down this is what he wants me to do. Well, I don't have to make that choice myself. So that's the beauty of creativity for me.
Yeah. I enjoy that. I enjoy that process. And I can you can only say this to another creative. Do you know that moment when it happens and it's apart from you, and then you look at the thing that you just did and you go, dude, that is brilliant.
Yeah, because you feel like this is an arrogant thing for me to say.
But you're an observer.
That's why people find it weird, like how, because I'm not, I've worked a lot of years. It's been very difficult, but I've worked very hard on not being very sensitive. Like I'm not very, I don't think I have much of an ego about me. You can say anything you want about me. I'll probably agree with half of it and laugh at you, but I'm a little baby when it comes to people, nitpicking something I've created, right? Yeah. That's when I'm, I don't even know if my ego is attached to that as much as it's the baby metaphor is the best one. This is my little creation, my little baby, and I protect it way more than I protect myself.
Yeah.
And that's, like you say, it's outside of me, and I can look at that little baby and go, oh my gosh, this is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And people don't understand the separation between artist and the work.
Yeah.
Because it came from outside of me, I can have that somewhat objective view of it and look at it like a mom looks at her baby as the most beautiful thing on earth. Not that I think that my movie Small Group is the most beautiful thing on earth, but there are some moments in there, because I'm so connected to it, that I do feel they're beautiful and do move people in that way. So yeah, I totally feel that way about it. And somehow I think I can reconcile that as not being from ego.
Yeah, I agree. And I love those moments to where it's like, oh my gosh, that's so freaking good. Like that is so like, and to be able to bring it, like, listen to this. And then when people go, dude, that's good. It's like, that's the only place that it gets weird. Dude, this is really good. And you're like, yeah, no.
Shucks.
Yeah, no, like, don't make it weird. Man. Like, just agree with me. This is really good. Like, oh, it's amazing.
Right.
Dude, you're so good. No.
I'm not good. I just kind of turn it. Okay, you think that'll work then? You think that'll work?
Yeah.
That's what I want. I want this thing to work. I want it to do what I need it to do. I need this moment to make the audience feel this. I need this moment to make the audience feel this. So if you're telling me it's that good, it's because you're affected by it, then we're doing what we're supposed to do. It works.
Yeah. I spent the last calendar year working on this book that I had been working on for about 10 years prior, but really, really working on it now. Like I was kicking it around, and then the last year or so, well, I got it done, and then I went and I recorded the audio. Well, when I was done recording the audio, I looked everywhere to try to find, because one of the things I wanted to do, because I'm a film junkie, just a junkie.
Cool.
Down to the point that I'm a film score junkie.
Ooh, you know? Cool.
Like if I'm not watching film, when I go to the gym and I know
you're listening to John Williams songs.
Yes, exactly what I'm doing. Yeah, for Hans Zimmer, you know, Pimbleton. I mean, these dudes are. Yeah. I mean, I've got it's. I love it, love it, love it. So what I wanted to do with this audiobook is I wanted to have somebody score it like a film.
Wow.
Which is crazy, because when you think about an audiobook, if you're talking 8 to 10 hours and someone's going to score and listen to this thing happen. Do you remember the old school days when you would listen to like the stories on maybe grade school on record or on cassette?
Sure.
And then remember there used to be some music in there.
There was some music into it, yeah.
But
now it's just typically, if you're lucky, you get like a little 3-second music flash at the beginning of the end of each chapter. But that's an interesting thing to want, but 8 hours worth of music, that's a lot of music. That's gonna cost you.
Yeah. So I'm looking everywhere. I'm looking everywhere for a guy.
And I mean, I got a couple composers. It'll cost you.
Here's what happened. I found one and I said to him, listen, I think this idea is good. Can I send you a couple of chapters and tell me what you think of scoring this? And he said, okay. And I'm gonna kid you, in a couple of hours, he scores the first chapter and sends it back.
Oh, wow.
And I listen to it and I'm like, oh my gosh. And that's just raw. That's just raw out of the.
Did he hit though what you thought? Did he?
Yeah, he nailed it.
And did he make it better than you thought it would be?
Oh my gosh. It was like, dude, I love this story. I love the story that I'd written. And it's a retelling of the book of 1 Samuel. And so.
Okay, so but it's narrative. It's not a position.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he nails this. I mean, nails it. And I'm like, good gracious. So now I got the awkward conversation I got to have with him where I got to say, and I don't have any money.
It'll be good exposure. Artists love hearing that. Can you give me all your time and efforts and talents? It'll be great exposure. They love hearing
so
that.
So here's what I tell him. Listen, here's the thing. This is not great for you. This is not great for you, but here's what I want to do. Can I cut you a percentage of this book? whatever it makes, just cut you a percentage. And he says, yeah, let's do that. And I said, okay.
Great.
And so we'll do it. And so he tells me, he said, how about 5%? And I said, okay, well, maybe. Hey, he sends me the first chapter and I'm already like, oh gosh, like 5%. I'm going to be a cheapskate. And
you're like, make it 10.
Can we do 10?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, so he's done. He just sent me chapter 4 the other day. And I mean, listen, every time he sends me one, I'm almost in tears. I'm like, golly, this story is, he finds the thing in there that I didn't think was the spot, the power moment.
Yeah.
And then storytelling, I got the power moment right. But musically, when he comes in and he hits these notes, I'm like, oh, it's over. I mean, I'm just,
it's waterworks. Fascinating. Man, that's collaboration, right? There's the second part of creativity that even levels up. It's fun to create something yourself. Mm-hmm. It's fun for you to have that moment in the shower and the treadmill, wherever you are, where God's like, do Second Samuel. But then when you find people to collaborate with, and then when you trust them with your baby, and they make your baby prettier, and they make your baby more effective. And man, that is a beautiful moment. I had a lot of those with what we did with small group and have many times and since then. So collaboration's great.
Man, it just blows my mind. One of the things that it did for me is it put me in the spot. At one point when I couldn't find a composer to a music guy to put this together, a friend of mine said, huh, that's too bad. You had to give birth to this baby and now you have to raise it, you know?
Yeah.
Cause I was like, I don't want to do the music to it. Like I could plunk it out
it wouldn't get to where you wanted it to be. Cause it's exactly.
Yeah. He's like, you got to give birth to it and now you got to raise it. I'm like, surely that's not it. I hope
it'll be uglier if I got to put clothes on.
I don't want to do that, you know, but man, I'm telling you what, I'll have to send you a couple bits of it.
That way you can hear that. Yes.
I mean, what he did it was just so incredible. I mean, and so he comes in and he does stuff to it. And I'll say to him like, dude, you nailed that. And he goes, yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. And like any other creative man, he can do it and go, I think it's okay. I don't know what. What's hard though is when you're in those situations and you're like, ooh, that wasn't quite it. You know, it's so hard to tell somebody that you didn't quite nail it there, which is that's the job of a director, which is very difficult to do. You got to be somebody who is, because it's very easy just to kind of be a pushover and go, yeah, I just want everybody to feel good about themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but you can't. You got to be about the thing. The thing has to be it. And if somebody doesn't bring their A game to the thing, then you got to either help them get there or replace them. But you can also be a control freak. You got to also be willing to open up and go, okay, they brought a very different take on this. Mm-hmm. And I like it.
That's like exactly it. Right.
That can be in the film business, that can be your composer. Mm-hmm. That can be, I had a casting director do that to me several times where she would bring me people and I'm like, that's not what I had envisioned. And what you brought me was way better than what I envisioned. Right. So like the character Billy is another example in small group. I had about 35, 40 year old biker guys. And then this one 20 year old baby-faced country boy from Arkansas, right? And she's like, this is your guy, this is him, just trust me. So that's the beauty of collaboration is when you let others take your work to a different level.
I was going to ask you in the creative process, when you venture into that place of being able to nail down the thing, it's like that's the thing, like it captures you. It moves you to a place of like, okay, so this is magic. When you talked about, I don't know how you can be an atheist and an artist, an atheist and a creative, that this is apart from you. And you know, this is apart. There's no question that this is apart from you. That when you begin to take that thing and you begin to move it out in front of you, have you had the experience as you've written and you're writing for these characters, for small group or anything else you've worked on, to where it's almost like you step into a room with this character, like almost like another dimension in the room with this character, interact with that character in a way of like, this is how he would act. This is how he would react. This is how he would respond to everything. Have you had this experience?
I mean, that's called flow for me. That's how I describe flow. And that's what I aim for every time I write. So absolutely. Like that's the, my most favorite part about it. I'll be sitting there writing, and even if I'm just writing an action line, I'll find myself doing the action that I'm seeing so that I can better describe the action.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're in it, man. You build this world visually. You see the sights, you hear the sounds, you know what this person's feeling, you know what that person's feeling. It's a little godlike to have to be, you know, to have to be able to be in them when you're creating something yourself. And so you just have, you know, stay humble with it is my thing, because I find it to be a giant responsibility. It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to create something that the others are going to be moved by, yeah, you gotta treat that power with gratitude and with a humble nature so that it can live up to what its potential is. But I feel it. It's almost like being hypnotized, right? I've never been hypnotized. I remember in college, I got on stage when this hypnotist came and I was like, I'm gonna try. And I feel like I was coming close. I was all of a sudden very dreamy. Everything felt like a dream. And then somebody sneezed or something, and I looked at them, and they're like, "You off stage." Too ADHD to be hypnotized, I think. But that's almost what it feels. And I think that scientists would describe that as the, you know, going from what, delta to alpha waves in your brain or something. But when you're there, when you are in that hypnotic state and you are interacting with it, it's that, you're exactly right. That's where the magic comes from, because it comes from outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes you as a writer to a different place. Working on a series right now. It's going to be an incredibly low budget, like YouTube, 7 to 10 minute episodes. But I'm as excited about this as I have been about anything that I've done in a long time. I'm also working on something far more important, I think. I was hired to write a screenplay that is an adaptation of a true story of one of the most amazing Navy SEALs ever to be a Navy SEAL.
Really?
that you've never heard of. This guy was buddies with Chris Kyle and knows all those guys, and he was there with them, and his story is as incredible as theirs, if not more so. And those are always good. That's more like that's an application of a skill that was learned, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm having to adapt something that really happened, and I've got to be creative enough to make it interesting, but not so much creative that I'm telling the wrong story, or I'm gonna force him to have to now go live a lie. So, but what's fun is when you can actually create everything about the world, and you're just you're buzzing. Like I said, I related it to a drug earlier, and it does feel like that. It's a drug that I certainly chase. I'm sitting there last night and I wrote two episodes of this thing yesterday, because I was just so and last night I'm sitting there, like I said, my daughter, a 13-year-old daughter who played Casey in the movie, she's got four friends over, and they're being loud as they can be, singing Justin Bieber on the other side of the house. Got my 6-year-old son here kicking me and telling me about his Roblox game, and I'm not even listening to any of it because I'm so into it. My wife looks at me and says something, and then she says something else, and then she says something else, and then accuses me of not listening to her or something. No, I'm kidding. She didn't. She just goes, "Hello."
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry. I'm able to so focus on this one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I found these little pockets as I'm going through First Samuel, and I'm writing, it's the First Samuel to the end to like chapter 2 of Second Samuel, and every single character, there's this deep dive into like who they are. And they're like, and it's weird because like I love acting. I love film. I love plays. I mean, I really am. I'm such a nerd about that stuff, but doing the deep dive on the characters and going into like, why in the world, what made Jonathan such an amazing friend to David and an amazing son to his dad? And like, how do you walk that line? And what kind of person is that to have to walk that line? You know, to be able to be this guy to him, this guy to him, and to be that honest, and there not be a shade of deceit on either side. And these two, like, one wants to, like, how do you? And so, man, it was like being in a room, with him, and being able to have, you know, 11 minutes to get as much information out of him as you possibly could. And then trying to just drag this information out. And I'm telling you what, by the time that process was over, by the time I got to King Saul, like, this dude who is what a terrible individual he is through most of his life.
Right.
There's a part of me that's so sympathetic. to what happened to Saul, because I feel like I spent so much time. It's like, how in the world, like, I can't throw all of him away. Like, I mean, God did pick him. There are some things in there that are valuable, and it's that deep dive where it almost brings your sympathies, you know, to the thing. Now, let me see if I can segue from that to something along these same lines. And this is the major, major sin that's being committed in Hollywood and in film and in storytelling right now, is they're not approaching this from a creative place. A lot of the stuff that's coming out now is being approached from an agenda, right?
Absolutely.
That's what makes people like me really, really sad, that we've given up on inspiration. We've thrown the ghost of it out. You know, there's no magic in it. Now it's a push, you know. Is that what you're seeing? Is that how you feel?
Oh, 100%. But I'll tell you this. I'm going to give you some hope there, because I think a movie or art in general can have three different desires, three different purposes. Number one, obviously, if it's the art, if it's storytelling, if it's inspiration, that's the most beautiful desire. Yeah. Number two is we just needed to make money. We got a formula. We needed to make money.
Sure.
That is, I would say, a far less desirable goal, but it's a more neutral goal. And then the third goal is no. I've got an agenda, and I'm going to get this agenda across to you. But here's the deal. Get the log out of our own eye. In the past 20 years of Christian movies, with a few exceptions, it's exactly what we've done. We just happen to believe that our agenda is better than the Hollywood agenda. But here's where I think we're in good shape, because we are 100% counterculture now. And it's happening more and more and more and more and more quickly. We're going to the counterculture. So the problem is, dominant culture is not good at art, because the dominant culture feels perfectly free to be expositional. Okay. They don't feel the necessity to hide their stories and their themes in subtext, in story. Okay. They feel perfectly fine to do that. So think about the 60s. Okay. Peter, Paul, and Mary. The 60s were our reaction to the 50s, where everything was as stiff and buttoned up as it could be. Peter, Paul, and Mary, they've discovered this awesome little substance that you roll up and smoke in a joint, and they want to sing about it, but they can't. The dominant culture won't allow them to do that. Mm-hmm. And so they sing a song called Puff the Magic Dragon, and everybody knows what they're saying, wink, wink, and it becomes a huge hit. And, you know, that stuff like that subtext in the art makes it technically better art. Sure. It moves people more. And then we get the revolution of the late 60s and early 70s. So, but now, and by the way, just 10, 20 years earlier, Charlton Heston was making the Ten Commandments as boldly and expositionally as possible, right? Because that was the dominant culture. Well, now Christians are in the subculture. And so if we're going to tell our stories, we're not going to be able to tell them expositionally. And that's a very good thing, because if you take a look at the book called Save the Cat, which is kind of the Bible for feature film screenwriting. Okay. It's basically talks about structure. His most common phrase is exposition kills cats. Remember that. Exposition kills cats. Meaning exposition is just the cardinal sin of storytelling. Because when the reader or the viewer starts feeling like they are being preached to, it takes them out of that hypnotic state. And now they're out of your story. Now they don't believe your story. So that's the beauty of what we're doing now, is that we get to now kind of weave Christian themes into our stories. We can't hit them over the head with it. You know, a lot of people say, well, you got to be bold with it. You got to tell them about Jesus.
That's right. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah,
that's actually not what Jesus told us to do exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's a process of leading them there. For me, this is God gave this to me. You can say he didn't or whatever. Call me crazy. I don't care. For me, the first step is to get people to make a decision or get people to understand that every topic they look at, every opinion they look at, every person who has an opinion they look at, they need to stop and ask themselves one very simple question. Does this seek truth or does this seek power? I will submit to you that that's one of the most foundational, if not the most foundational truth in our dichotomy, certainly in everything. For me, the truth seeking versus power seeking is the equivalent dichotomy of evil versus good. Okay. And so, but I don't want to speak in terms of evil and good. I may not speak in terms of God and Satan, because those terms will kind of push people aside, and not that they're not, we'll come back to those terms. We're going to get there. Sure, don't worry. Sure. But the first step is, okay, I want people who would reject the gospel because of other stupid reasons to at least start at the purpose of, do you want to seek truth or do you want to seek power? Because if you want to seek truth, truth looks like this. It follows these rules. Power looks like this. It follows these rules. You know that seeking truth is going to lead to a happy individual, happy group, happy society, a society that's connected to God because God is truth, and seeking power. Like, if you look at every story in the Bible, it's all about, almost every one of them is about, did this person seek truth from God, or did this person seek power to empower himself, to have power over others? It's all about that. So if you can start them there, and you got a society full of truth seekers because you've woven that into art, guess where they're going to eventually get to if you're actually seeking truth? They're going to really get to the gospel.
Yeah, that is hopeful. That's very hopeful. I mean, because I just told my wife the other day, I was like, man, I went to a movie, and because I love going to films by myself. I love going to movies by myself, because we're not going to the bathroom. We're not getting popcorn. We're not, you get to focus. And listen, I'm like you. Like, I don't need any distractions at all. Or, you know, I mean, I love, when I came back from when I was like, dude, I'm about to give up. I'm about to just give up on everything Hollywood's putting out. Like, I sweep the corners of independent films, you know. I mean, I go looking for the stuff that's like, what's the stuff that's really gonna, man, I was really getting, and I'll tell you what, there's been a couple that have come out here that I thought, man, this is gonna be awesome. And they weren't. And then there were a couple that came out and I thought, no, this is just a remake, you know?
And it's right.
They killed the story. You know, I was impressed by Maverick. And I was impressed by Creed 3. I mean, both of those. I thought the first two were terrible. I was bored to tears. And then
they got you to watch the third one then.
Well, it was one of those things that my buddies around me were like, dude, I'm so excited to see Creed 3. And I'm like, dude, those first two were brutal. You know? Yeah. But the third one, different director.
Well, that's good. Glad they give the director a little license to do something real with it, because you're right. These days they don't do that. They're not movies aren't like you say, seeking some kind of a foundational truth, some kind of a good inspiration. They're just, like you say, they're there to push an agenda. But I don't watch a lot of movies personally. I feel like cinema has gone to the point where it's either independent film, which is, you know, mostly like these, it just feels very, very like film students trying to do something artful, and sometimes
this is called Sweater.
Yes, it's so deep, man. Or it's just Marvel crap. Marvel crap. Now, I don't mind Marvel crap for what it is. For me and my 6-year-old son sit down and watch Iron Man together, and he's like, "Yeah, that's fun. I like that."
Sure.
But for me, like cinematic storytelling definitely moved to TV. So, you know, and it's in series TV now, and are they telling Christian stories? Almost none of them are, but that doesn't mean they're not telling good stories, because there are. It's possible. I'm a big fan of the Taylorverse. Anything Taylor Sheridan does, I'm in. Yes, it's violent. Yes, it's cursing. Yes, it's crazy. But he's a fantastic storyteller, and I think he's more of a truth seeker than he is a power seeker, for sure.
Okay, so Taylorverse, you said?
They call it the Taylorverse. Taylor Sheridan, he was the creator of Yellowstone, 1883, 1923, all those. Yeah, Yeah.
So I love good world builder. Like builds the entire world for you.
The Taylorverse, the Taylor universe. Exactly.
Yeah, man, he's good. He's real good.
Yeah, I love him. Love him. So that stuff still does exist, but it's hard. And Holly, and that's the other thing too, is that you can't get anything into that awful machine of Hollywood unless you check some boxes. For instance, you know, our distributor. I had the idea that Niven wrote a pilot episode for Small Group, the series, and it was going to be shot. It was going to be just like The Office, a mockumentary. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that this movie that Coop made in our movie, sat on a shelf for 5-6 years. It got put on ChristianCinema.com or something and exploded. And so now they've been hired to do a reality show. Okay, and so Coop's behind the camera. You never see him. You see him take the lens off. He's like, I'm not going in front of the camera again. But it's very, very much like The Office. It's a mockumentary. It's all interviews and that where they know the cameras are there. And it was the first episode's really good. It's really funny. I had a whole series Bible written out, and my distributor took it to Netflix, and they're like, well, that's interesting, very interesting. But if we do this, they're going to have you know, an LGBTQ trans person in the group. They're going to have to, you know, have this view and that view, and they can't have this view or that view. And I'm like, I'm out. Yeah. I'm out. I'm out. I'm done. I just want to share I want to tell a story of normal people trying to pursue the gospel. And I'm not going to have to infuse it with your political opinions du jour.
Yeah. Have you seen anything on Ted Lasso on Apple TV?
Everybody's talking to me about Ted Lasso. I've not watched it yet, because there's only so many subscription services you should get, you know? And so
no, there's not. You can have them all.
You can have them all. Well, maybe you can have them all. What are they paying pastors these days? Because they're not paying filmmakers enough to
it's outrageous.
Yeah.
you need to get in on it while it's hot.
I suppose. I go to a tiny church. Okay. Our church, we can barely afford to pay our pastor gas
poor,
money to drive
poor
over.
Guy. Poor guy.
Yeah, we're a small group, small church.
Yeah, well, us too. This
more of an Eric Kahn type church.
Oh, who's that?
Oh, you know Eric Kahn, the Hard Man podcast.
No, I'll check him out.
That's going to be the best thing you've got out of this whole thing. Go follow Eric Kahn.
Okay.
Go listen to the Hard Man podcast, and that'll be the best thing you got out of our time together today. It's fantastic.
Hey, let me tell you a guy, Father William Costco. My guess is you've seen him before. There was a video that was floating around of a Catholic priest, and the caption was Catholic priest obliterates Biden. He's wearing a green robe and he's talking about abortion.
Okay.
He's saying how he would welcome Joe Biden into his church, but over his dead body, would he serve in communion?
I think I remember the story, but I don't remember seeing the guy.
Well, I had to find this cat, look him up, and get an interview with him. And listen, when I did, I had to leave it on an old school answering machine at his parish. And listen, he has a flip phone, and he will text. I think I have 2 text messages from him in the time that we've known each other. Here's what's interesting about his story. He was in L.A., went to film school, and this is what he was doing. He was going to make it in creating films.
Wow.
And then he said one day, you have to go back and check him out. He says, I've worked so hard to build a platform that I could get on and get in on this machine so that I could say what I wanted to say to the world. He said, and then I started asking myself, what do I want to say to the world? He said, so I got a bike and I rode it to New York. And by the time I got there, I realized I wanted to be a priest. And so I went into the ministry. from LA and film school all the way across. So now he's in, where is he?
I did not expect you to say, so then I got a bike and rode it from LA to New York.
Listen, he is in the sermon. And here's the other deal. This is one of the only sermons you'll find online of William Costco. It's the one, and it just went absolutely viral. He doesn't have a podcast. He doesn't have
William Costco.
You can't find any
of his.
He
stopped looking for his platform.
And listen,
seeking attention.
Stepped forward. Yeah, you're exactly right. He stepped forward, said the one thing, and he said the only reason I recorded that sermon was because I didn't want to get in trouble from the bishops and everybody else, and people say I said something I didn't say. So I had him record it.
And it was a CYA move more than a let's put this out there.
I mean, Shapiro picked it up.
Wow.
Charlie Kirk picked it up. Candace
Owens. If you just have something to say, you don't have to have a giant audience, and it will get said. I just felt like riding my bicycle across the great country of U.S.
That's what he did. So,
wow. Yeah, I got to look that guy up.
Father William Costco. I can email you a link to my conversation with him. So he and I have been in conversation ever since. We've become fantastic. Good friends, and I mean, just a neat guy. And so every once in a while I have something creative I'm working on, I'll send it to him. And he's a super, you'll find some other videos of him, and it's him mostly clowning around as a, next film you put together, you ought to hunt this cat down. Good actor, hilarious.
That's interesting.
I mean, you might get some really good ideas from looking at somebody, because he's a wild one, man.
I want to go hang out with the guy. He's in New York, you said?
No, not anymore. Now he's in, where is he? He's in Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Arizona, I think.
Arizona. I go out there every now and then. Got some friends out there.
I'd have to look and see.
One interesting thing to me that you mentioned there is the fact that he first looked to build a platform. So he was almost attention seeking.
Yeah.
Then he went the other way with it. And now he's just attention paying. Right. Yeah. So if I'm not I don't usually send people to TED Talks because you know what they've become.
Sure.
But I posted this TED Talk the other day because it just blew me away. And talking about the creative process here is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the actor.
Oh.
He gives this TED Talk. I want to say it was in 19 when he gave it, but it's this just incredibly beautiful talk about creativity and about kind of how that works in our modern society and about social media and the product that it sells. But he breaks it down to basically, you know how my dichotomy is either you seek truth or you seek power. Mm-hmm. In that same dichotomy, he's saying that either you are giving attention or you are, or you're either seeking attention or you are paying attention. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's it. Just those two things. And so when you are, he says, when he's on set and he hears that, all right, rolling, speed, camera speeding, action. He's like, that's hypnotic for him. And it's an addiction to him because, and I understand that as an actor, because it allows you to zone in almost to that same hypnotic state that I was talking about in writing.
Sure.
And then you basically become your character. Mm-hmm. And you're in a different realm. You're not in the world outside it. Yeah. Yes, there are cameras and everything, but it's almost like you're in a dream. You're in this hypnotic state. And it's addicting because you are at the core of paying attention. That's where creativity goes. He said, however, when you're on Twitter, you are seeking attention. He's like, mm-hmm. He's as guilty as anybody, right?
Yeah, that's
and
good.
He's like, and all actors do it. He's like, I've got 5 million followers or whatever on Twitter, but Tom Cruise has 50 and I feel like a failure. He said, and so the message there is that he's like, you can, they've done studies on this. People who pay attention and get in that state of flow are always fulfilled and they're joyful. He says happiness, but I think it's more than that. I think it's you're in a state of joy when you are paying attention. Mm-hmm. And he said that no matter how much attention you get when you're seeking attention, it's like crack or it's heroin. You can never get enough. So you're never fulfilled when you're seeking attention.
It's true. It's universal across. I mean, so here's mine. His is paying attention or giving attention, right? Mine is, are you consuming the world around you? Or are you creating a world around you? Like, which is it? Because the minute I become a consumer is the minute I go empty. And the minute I become a creator to where I give is the minute I'm fulfilled over and over and over.
Yeah. This is why TikTok is an evil thing, or it's not just TikTok. TikTok found this formula, and maybe somebody found it before they did, Vine or whatever, found this formula of these little shorts. Facebook does it now. Mm-hmm. YouTube does it now. They all do it now. And it, you know as well as I do, man, it's addictive. And you just, you're laying in bed trying to go to sleep. And you're never as dumb a human as you are an hour after you sat down with your phone to look at those stupid reels. Again, I don't have TikTok on my phone, but I got Facebook, and I'm giving all of my attention to this garbage.
I'm telling you.
So unfulfilled.
Yeah.
But it's easier to do that. And that's a problem. And that's what social media does. He talks about how social media sells our attention. And so if you as an influencer get a lot of attention, that's good for social media because they're selling that attention to other people.
Yeah.
So it's that's why social media has become not in and of itself evil, but the power of it has been an absolute detriment to civilization because everybody now is seeking attention. I'm riding to my dad's house the other day. They live in Atlanta, and I was going to go stay there before I had a flight to D.C. the next day, and I'm going to stop and pick him a pizza. So I'm going down right in Midtown Atlanta, and I'm driving. I'm looking, and there everywhere I look, there are these women who are all dolled up, and they're all carrying DSLR cameras. Some of them have their just phone cameras, but they're all on gimbals pointed at themselves and walking down the street. I'm like, that's where we are as a society, where everybody is seeking so much attention because, I mean, frankly, that's what they get. I mean, they get rewarded for it, but they're all seeking attention. Everybody's just seeking attention. Nobody's seeking to move someone with story like you and I talked about from the beginning. They just want the attention. It's a short-term dopamine hit that is absolutely ravaging our society.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the guy named Andrew Huberman?
No.
Huberman Lab. Andrew Huberman. You should check him out sometime. Okay. He does a bunch of stuff on dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he talks about is he says anything that gets you dopamine quick becomes very, very dangerous. He said, because you run at a baseline, a normal baseline. He said, and if you spike it with very little effort, you don't return to baseline. You go beneath baseline.
That's right.
Then you have to come back up. And I mean, he just, in talking about that, it's like, man, you got to be careful. You got to be careful with your brain, which was one of the first glimpses for me into understanding exactly or what I think is close to when you hear the phrase that sexual immorality is the only sin that you can commit against your own body. So I think part of what's built into that is what it does to your brain chemistry, what it does to your body chemistry, as you spike yourself and then you depress yourself and then you've got to fight. Now you're a survivalist in your own body trying to just feel okay. And it's like, that is so terrible, you know?
And it's like any other drug. Yeah, it's like any drug. They take you here, then a little lower. Then you try to get back to there and a little lower. Everybody knows that cycle until you hit rock bottom. Yeah, you're exactly right. But the phrase I think that stood out the most for me as to what you just said was that with little effort, okay?
Little effort.
That's one of the beautiful themes in the Bible for me is that suffering is a good thing. Like we are supposed to suffer in so many different ways because when you suffer, good things come from that.
Yeah.
The working out is suffering and I need to go suffer a lot more than I do. But there are so many things that are suffering, you know. I mean, an 18-year-old boy who's may not get married till he's 25 and waiting to know his wife till he's 25, that's a suffering 7 years.
Suffering.
Yeah. And that's suffering worse than most any woman could ever know.
Suffering. This poor kid's about to chew his arm off. You know,
yes, I would chew my arm off for 7 days, much less 7 years.
Agreed.
But it's the theme. Good things come to those who suffer. Who suffered? Look at the number one entity that we all look to for everything is Jesus Christ, the number one example. And he suffered the greatest. Mm-hmm. So if he did that, why am I, or even as a parent? Why do I keep my kids from suffering? Mm. This is something that I was talking to my wife about this morning. The younger boomers and the older Gen Xers had this, I think, just hugely mistaken kind of thing going around the zeitgeist that, look, my parents were really tough on me. They were World War II people. And so I'm going to give my kid everything I didn't have. Right. I'm going to make their lives easy. That, because they took away the suffering from their children's lives, and then parents nowadays do it big time. We can go into that. But, I mean, it started way back then. When they start taking away any discomfort or any suffering, then life just becomes about trying to find these cheap dopamine hits.
Yeah.
And that's going to be – that's the recipe for our civilization completely crumbling.
Yeah. I heard a coach on a clip the other day. He said something about, he was talking about baseball, and he said, why are 48% of the players in the MLB from out of the country? He's like, 48% of them, you know? He said, let me tell you why. He said, because the 48% that are from out of the country, they don't have rings. They don't have big rings that they won at select baseball. You know, we didn't give him some massive championship ring. He said, and he starts talking. He's like, the Cubans, the Puerto Ricans. He said, if you ever watched any of these guys play, they play ball because they live. He said, they love ball.
They
he
love said, it.
But joyous. They love the throwdown. He said, that's what they love. These other ones, they love the ring. These guys, they love the. And he said, this is why when my grandson comes up and plays a kid the same age from another country, my grandson will lose because he has a ring. And they love the throwdown. And it's like, that's 100% true.
Absolutely. They grew up in a situation where they weren't being coddled. Weren't being, even worse, treated like little kings. They were playing in dirt lots, you know. And like in Atlanta, we love ourselves some Ronald Acuna Jr. and Ozzie Albies. They watching those guys play, you get the joy of the game again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because they didn't grow up being treated like little gods. Mm-hmm. They grew up with adversity. So
yeah,
that's all it's gonna take. We're gonna have our civilization's about to crumble, and then we're gonna have major adversity, and it cycles around unless Jesus comes, and he might. All it's gonna happen is that we're gonna the adversity over a few generations is going to create strong people, and strong people are going to create a good society again.
Yeah. We'll be back where we started. Just in time to screw it up again.
It's all cyclical. It is.
Hey, let me tell you a quick story, that you're going to at least appreciate. So there's this pattern in my life, and listen, God loves to give me things. He just loves to give me things, and I'm not bragging. I'm just saying he loves to give me things, and I think part of the reason why is because I'm a billboard. And because he's good, but because I am screaming all the time. It's like something new comes. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? I can't believe this. That's awesome. Like,
are we about to launch into a Joel Osteen sermon? I'm not ready.
No, it's even better than that. It's even better than that. So I see that Jordan Peterson is coming to Kansas City.
Oh yeah.
So I say to a buddy of mine, I said, hey, I picked up Jordan Peterson tickets. Got one for me, one for you. I said, you interested? He's like, absolutely. I said, well, we're about five rows from the back. And he's like, really? He's like, yeah. He said, do we need to get a hotel? I was like, nah, we don't need to get a hotel. I said, we're just going to go to the show. We're going to be in the back. We'll slide out. As soon as it's done, we'll be done. He's like, oh, okay. We go on a Monday night. But the Sunday before, I'm having dinner with another buddy of mine. And I said, man, my buddy Mike's going to be pretty worked up tomorrow night. He's like, why? And I said, because you know what's going to happen, right? Like, I'm going to go to Jordan Peterson tomorrow night. We're going to get there. I'm five rows from the back. But you know what's going to happen. Like, I'm going to get there, and somebody's going to have backstage pass tickets for me, front row. Like, this is what happens. Like, the Lord loves to give me stuff like this. I said, this is what's going to happen. I said, we're going to be there all night long because I'm going to be with JP and my buddy Mike. He's going to be waiting in the parking lot. You know, and this is what's going to happen. And my buddy looks at me and he goes, knowing you, probably, you know. And Monday comes around. We go. We stand in line. It's raining. It's an absolute mess. But I got on my favorite wool overcoat. I'm super amped up. Everybody's dressed like they're going to prom. And so we're lined up. It's raining. We all look like drowned rats. We get in. I'm sitting five rows from the back on the aisle seat. And coming from beside me, I look up and I catch a glimpse of a lady who I know. I know this lady. And I'm like, what is she doing? So I said her name. I said, hey, hey. And she turns around. She goes, oh my gosh, Jared, how are you doing? I was like, good. She's like, I didn't know you love Jordan Peterson. I said, I love Jordan Peterson. She said, oh, me too. My son loves Jordan Peterson. She said, I got him tickets because it's his birthday. And she starts in the store. And then she just freezes. I got him tickets because it's his birthday. And then, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this. And I, in my mind, I'm like,
I know what's coming.
I know exactly what's coming. And she says, I'm sitting beside a guy down front who bought two. Backstage, all meet and greet, get your picture taken with Jordan Peterson. He got one for him and one for his brother. and his brother didn't come. I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. Go to the will call booth. Tell him you're there to pick up your ticket. The guy left it there and said, just give it to anybody who wants it. She said, it's up there. Go get it. I said, oh, maybe I will. Maybe I will. So, you know, talk to my buddy Mike and say, hey, I said, I'll be right back. I go to the will call booth. Okay, I said, hey, I don't know how this works, but do you have a meet and greet pass for me? She goes, oh, hold on, let me look. She turns around. Oh, yeah. Here you go, it's right here. And hands me the meet and greet VIP pack. Are you kidding me right now? So I get done. I go.
You only had to commit identity theft to do it, right?
I didn't have to say a word. I didn't have to say one.
Oh, you didn't even
word.
Say your. You didn't say like no, my name is John.
No,
Smith.
No. It's like, hey, did somebody leave one a meet and greet pass up here for me? She says, that's yeah, yeah, yeah. Here you go. Hey, so take it. I go sit back down. Which I never thought about it. I never thought about me stealing somebody else's. What if the brother changed his mind? He's like, what the? What?
Or the other brother was just playing a trick on his brother. Oh, yeah. It's the impractical jokers backstage laughing.
He really hates him. You know, he really hates his brother. So,
yeah.
Hey, I got you a ticket. It's there. Never mind. It's gone. And so I go sit down beside my buddy Mike and I said, hey, check this out. And I hand him the ticket. And he goes, the show hadn't started yet. And he goes, dude, this is on the second row. He's like, you going to go down there? Like, no, man. I'm with you. I'm sitting right here. This is fine. I can hear him just fine. I can see him just fine. Like, I'm being closer. That's not going to matter. But afterward, I'm gonna hang out. So, anyway, so we get done. Stick around. My buddy has to go to the car and go down, walk up. Jordan Peterson said, I said, hey, how you doing? He said, what's your name? I said, I'm Jared. He said, hey, it's Jared. I said, hey, appreciate all your work. He said, thank you. Hey, listen, he puts his arm around me and he goes, huh, I really like this coat. I said, yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Got a picture taken, got in the car, and I said, you know what? The Lord loves to give me stuff.
Apparently so, yeah.
Loves to give me stuff. Isn't that great?
Jordan's like, it's not obvious to me that you're the guy on this ticket.
I mean, it's not obvious. It's
not obvious to me that you. Hey, oh my gosh. I mean, I'm a fanboy, dude. That's a great story.
Oh, man, me too.
God did not give me Jordan Peterson tickets. If he did, I'd be okay with it.
Oh, man.
I want to meet that guy. My problem is I would have a hard time going, hey, nice to meet you. Shake hands, leave. I'd be like, let's go hang out. You want to go get some pancakes? Yeah. Let's be best friends.
Time. Yeah, I need some time.
Come hang out with me.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be on my podcast?
What a monumental space he has filled up, you know?
It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, the last two times he's gone on Joe Rogan, he has used over an hour of his time to talk about the Bible, which I find fascinating because he's a bit of an enigma with his own place, his own kind of belief, but he's doing what we're supposed to do, and that's dive in and explore it, and he explores it more deeply than 99.9% of us who are supposedly going to church and doing it for real. But as a pastor, what do you think about that? Have you listened to his kind of his deep dives on different books of the Bible, and do you think that him coming from someone who was at one point an atheist who this point still is kind of an agnostic, I think he's a believer. I don't know that he would even consider himself to be a Christian because he speaks in terms of archetype and things like that more than he does about reality. But I find his analysis just brilliant. And maybe his somewhat outside analysis gives him a viewpoint of the books of the Bible that I just frankly haven't heard coming from the pulpit. And I don't think it's just because it's not obvious to me that it's just because he's wrong. And he's interpreting the Bible wrong is what a lot of what my more Calvinist friends would say is that it's coming from a different perspective, and it's wrong because there ain't but one interpretation of the Bible, and that's exactly what I think it is.
That's right.
So, but what do you think of that as a pastor's perspective?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, my introduction to Jordan Peterson happened before the Bill C-16 thing ever came up. Before he was ever a public figure. Mm. I stumbled across him when I was in the process of looking at this idea of victimhood and perpetrator, that if you're going to take the position of a victim, someone that instantly makes, and it's completely anti-Christian to be a victim, because then you have to make somebody else the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic. That's problematic with the fundamentals of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just perusing, I'm looking some stuff up, and I get on YouTube and I stumble across this Canadian psychologist giving a lecture The video's got about 264 views, and I'm looking at this and I'm like, dude, this guy's brilliant. Yeah. And he's not terrible to listen to, but
yeah.
And so it kind of became my own weird little secret sugar stash.
Right, that's a good point. Like, we're looking.
Yeah, me listening to this Canadian, and it's people, yeah, like, so what are you watching? What are you listening to? I'm like, yeah, no, this is weird. This is a little, right, Canadian.
Such an obscure guy. You're like that guy who found this band back in the 89, 90, and nobody knows about him, and it's called Nirvana. And
I know. Yeah, I know.
But now I don't like him because everybody else does.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I'm way over him now. No. So
JP, I liked him back when he was fat and had black hair. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked his stuff from Harvard, but his stuff from, yeah, you know, no.
No, it's just become pedestrian.
Yeah. Good line. Yeah, so I'm listening to it and I'm like, dude, this dude is rock solid. I'm like, this is really, and I just thought it was one of those things. It's like, I'll probably run out of the videos of his to watch at some point. And then all of a sudden this thing happened, and then these videos had millions of views.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hold on a second. And then it's a book, and then it's a thing, and then it's a, so for me, I've got zero trouble getting on board with what Jordan Peterson's doing. But I think part of the problem with a lot of Christians, with a lot of people who land in that place of, so what do you do with a guy like Jordan Peterson, who's obviously a heretic? And it's kind of like, hold on, it's not
obvious to me that he's a heretic.
It's not so obvious to me that you're not a heretic.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, yeah. And so to me, where I go is, listen, God has got you on a path, and what you're doing is lighting up people's lives, and it's changing their world, and it's drawing them back to God. So let me jump off of that, and I'll answer the question by giving you a little bit of a story. Can you imagine if you are laying in bed at night? Now, not now. You probably have a really good handle on this idea now. But if you're laying in bed at night and you fall asleep, and then you have this dream, you are in the hands of God, and like a little toy soldier, he's got this key in the back of you, and he's wound you up, and he's getting ready to set you loose on the world, right?
Yep.
All of heaven is looking over his shoulder, and they're just like, oh my gosh, like they've seen what these other people do. They've seen, but God, like, what does this one do? Mm. What did you make this one for? Mm. You know, can you imagine, like, it's you dreaming about God holding on to you, winding you up, so proud, ready to set you down, and like, mm-hmm, you can see it in his eyes. Jesus is even looking over his shoulder like, hey, Dad, like, what'd you make this one for? And then God turns around, and he turns and he addresses the audience, the massive audience behind him. And he says, I've created this one too. And then you wake up from your dream. How fast are you going to try to go back to sleep? How fast are you going to try to catch the end of that dream? Like, what was he going to say? Like, that information right there, like, what did you make me for? Like, that is so vital.
Right.
And you can only get that. You can only get that from God. Like, you don't get to just, oh, I'm going to create my own way. It's like, you're not going to create a way. You're going to create a distraction. You're going to create something to pass the time. But unless you find that deal, you don't get fulfillment. You don't get contentment. You get distraction. That's what you get, you know? To me, when I look at a guy like Jordan Peterson, here's what I see. I see God in the shadows of everything that Jordan Peterson's got going on. And I see God slowly going, now listen, come this way. Come this way. Take another step this way. Take another step. It's absolutely fascinating to me to watch him migrate from a place of atheism and being an agnostic to the place of him saying something along the lines of, you really need to understand the logos. And it's, yeah, like, dude, that's a preacher word. That's
John 1:1.
That's right.
In the beginning.
That's right.
It was the logos.
That's
wasn't
right.
It wasn't the word. It was logos. Yeah.
And so he says that all the way to the point to where he says, I'm not exactly sure what to do with Jesus, but I'm not ready to throw him away just yet. Or when he has the dream, and he's talking in front of this panel of people, and he says, I had a dream one time that all the kings of the earth were buried in a church cemetery, and they all came out of the grave at the same time. Have you seen this video? Mm-mm. And they all look at each other. And as soon as all the kings of the earth, it's Alexander the Great, it's Genghis Khan, it's whoever these people are, as soon as they see each other, they draw their swords and they start fighting. And he says, and then somebody else walks into the cemetery. He said it was Jesus. And when he does, They all bowed down on their knees before him. And Jordan Peterson's telling this, like, this is a dream I had. And then here's what he says. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that. And it's like, dude, do you, like, you have to understand, like the Lord is, like, he's drawing you. Like, he's drawing you over.
He knows that, too, I think. And he's okay.
I agree. So yeah. To me, what I see with him is, my guess is he's probably going to get as much scripture right as I am. He's probably, his understanding of the vastness of God from a different perspective and a different catalog of study than mine is probably as on point or more on point because he's brilliant than mm-hmm. mine is. Mm-hmm. I mean, mine's limited to the 45 years that I've been alive, mm-hmm. 18 to 35 of those have probably been wasted years that, you know,
I'm trying not to waste this one.
Right. And so I'm going to think, so let's just give me 10 years
yeah.
of really maybe potentially pursuing Jesus. And then I'm going to say my understanding of the way this is true and right based on the guys that I went to school and listened to teach me stuff who I imagine they probably wasted 18 to 20 years before they, you know. So to me, I don't have a problem with Jordan Peterson. I don't have a problem with this, with where he's going on his hunt. I also trust that a guy like him has the honesty and the humility that if Jesus steps foot in his life and says, make me Lord of your life, Jordan Peterson will bow to his knees and make it happen.
Oh, 100%. This is what I love about Jordan Peterson. It's exactly like I told you. He is the perfect example of what I told you, is that that if we're truth seeking, you're going to end up there.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why we love Jordan Peterson. And that's why you loved the atheist version of Jordan Peterson, because he had taken imagine we're all on a river, right? And it's a river of kind of choices, and present new metaphors. For me, the very first place that river forks is, do you seek truth or do you seek power?
That's so good.
You may seek truth and you go down this way, and there's a lot of ways before you get to the capillaries of Christianity, but you made the first choice, and he made that first choice. There's another, because I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of his. I'm also a huge fan of Brett Weinstein and Heather Hying. They're the Dark Horse podcast. Okay. So for somebody like me, a Southern born and raised white, cisgendered, straight male, evangelical Christian, staunchly conservative.
Right.
That's me over here. And them, they're, you know, Northeastern born Jewish liberal atheist evolutionary biologist. Mm-hmm. Why would these two seem to fit so well?
Yeah.
Because they're truth seeking. And yeah, I'm watching them even. It's going to be harder to get them to Jesus, but I do see them inching closer and closer to at least admitting that there is a higher power. You'll see them in their journey of truth seeking is fun to watch, but they're also incredibly brilliant, and their truth seeking has really a lot of godlike, not to say godlike, but a lot of applications in society that would be pleasing to God. That's where we start. Let's bring all the truth seekers together. And let's all just encourage each other to seek truth, know what truth is, and be able to recognize when people are power seeking or when we ourselves are power seeking. And you're going to, like Jordan Peterson did, you're going to end with the gospel. It's the only place to end. Yeah. The reason he had that dream is because if you take all the great leaders of the world, all the great kings, they were all power seekers, because they had to be, because their job as king is to organize this bunch of hairless monkeys. I mean, and that's a hard thing to do, and it's almost impossible to do it without becoming, you know, more obsessed with the power. It's like any organization. You take any organization, a church, a nonprofit, any group of people, certainly governments, and once they grow to a certain size, what's needed to maintain order in that group of people ends up tipping us over into the power-seeking scale, where that our focus becomes on maintaining that bureaucracy and not the thing, the bureaucracy, or the very tenets and values that brought us together in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, and I've seen that in churches, and that's the problem with the American church these days, I believe, is that they grew too big. We should have millions of little churches rather than a bunch of, or a handful of giant ones, in my opinion.
That's a great conversation. And at some point we ought to explore that, because I do not agree. I mean, I do not disagree with you at all, but that's so, I mean, anytime you see this with dogs, like, you start breeding dogs to get the biggest breed that you can possibly get. This thing is so fragile. It's so dumb. Mm-hmm. It's so predisposed to diseases and things that are going to, its hips give out. It doesn't function well when it gets older. It's more susceptible to cancer. I mean, you see this on any level. And as soon as you take something and you try to inflate it and make it bigger, like, this is what you get. You break it. Yeah.
But, and that's a human quality, human nature quality, maybe an organic, but I guess going back to that dream he had, the one person in history who was different, who was also a king, was Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's what you want proof of his divinity. You can take that from the things that he said, because no one had ever approached it in that way. No one had every person propelled to as a king would have ridden in on Palm Sunday on the biggest chariot he could find. I'm the king. I'm here, baby. Dude rides in on a tiny little donkey that had never really ridden anybody. I mean, that's perfect example of his humble nature, that he did not want to be a political leader. He wanted to lead each individual in your heart with a heart of self-sacrifice and a heart of truth seeking and a heart of dying to ourselves, so this greater goodness called God could shine through us. No one has ever approached it that way, and that's how you could know that Jesus is who he says he was. Because some people will tell me especially about Jesus, oh yeah, he's probably a great guy, he's a really good dude. Yeah. I'm like, no, because here's the thing: either he is who he says he was, or he was a crazy person.
Yeah,
he was either the biggest nut job in the history, or he is who he says he was.
Yeah.
There's no that's a dichotomy. That's certainly a binary view.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you. I mean, you come in on a stick horse instead of on a stallion.
Right.
This is a different animal altogether. You know, one of the things you said when you talk about the truth and power, isn't it interesting that even Father William Costco, Jordan Peterson, I mean, probably the same is true for me and for you. We pursue truth, and there's a certain amount of power that's handed over to you. Mm-hmm. You pursue power, and you're not guaranteed any truth whatsoever.
Amen to that.
You know, hey, you said something earlier, and I'll kind of close us out with this. The Ecclesiastes 7. You're talking about suffering is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Man, I tell you what, I'm so pain averse. I'm so avoidant. You know, when it comes now, listen, not physical, like,
yeah.
I'm an ice. I love ice baths. I do them almost every single day. Yeah. Love them.
I'm
love
with jiu-jitsu, you,
the way. I mean, love the physical exhaustion part. I got a row machine in my office. I mean, I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm so pain avoidant when it comes to the emotional. Emotion. Yeah, yeah, the emotional side. But I was reading in Ecclesiastes 7 the other day, and a sad face is good for the heart.
Mm.
That's what it says in Ecclesiastes. Mm. The house of mourning is better than the house of feasting. And I'm telling you what, it was taking me some time to I don't like the way this shirt fits. Not one single bit, you know, I don't.
Because it's uncomfortable.
It's so uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable, you know. What are the things that you find personally in your own life that you find yourself retracting from and withdrawing from?
Oh, I'm the exact same as you in that way. I think there's certain personality types who just deal with things differently. And my personality type is like yours. I feast on enthusiasm. Mm. People whose kind of main personality trait is enthusiasm, we do have a naturally little bit harder time, I think, facing things that are painful. Now, I can face things that are painful to me, okay? I don't mind that, but I am a wreck when I have to face empathy for empathy pains for someone else. Doesn't mean I'm not empathetic. It actually means I feel like I'm too empathetic sometimes. Yeah. But like if we're watching, I'm watching a movie, or I can be watching American Idol and they're tearing the backstories, and my kids look over and I'm crying. but I avoid that kind of thing typically. Like if I'm scrolling Facebook and I see some story of some child being hurt or whatever, child abuse stories, I kind of just can't. I kind of can't. And mm-hmm. I should, but I kind of can't, because just like you, yep. I just have a hard time getting close to that kind of pain. Now, yeah. Luckily, I think I can, and maybe I do. Maybe I'm the same way to my own pain. I don't know, but I'm definitely that way. And I don't want to go into the whole Enneagram is the cult, but what a lot of the soccer moms these days like to talk in terms of the Enneagram, and it's you're a seven, so you have that. And I don't know if that stuff's true or not, but I do know that people do tend to have certain personality types. Yeah, and my personality type, like yours, is one who I avoid that kind of pain. But I'm probably better at facing it because I have to in story. I love actually diving into pain in story.
In story, it's easy.
Yeah, it's a different place.
For so me. Much I mean, easier. Looking
in small group, there's that one scene that I've had so many, and I don't want to. Mm. Give it away, but so many mothers and fathers have come to me and said, "You punched me in the stomach with that one because it happened to us."
Yep.
And so, I wrote it into that because it happened to a friend of ours, and I've seen it happen to a lot of people. But in story, I can do it. I can get as raw as I need mm-hmm. to be. But mm-hmm. I'm with you, man. Sometimes I avoid that type of suffering in my own life, and it certainly is not what I'm supposed to do, and I got to work on that for sure.
Yeah, it makes me.
I need to suffer physically more, but I am like you also. I was in Estonia in 2019, and I saw these ladies jump into the Baltic Sea in November, and I'm like, what are those crazy people doing? Somebody fish them out. And they're like, nah, everybody does that. So me and my buddy were like, well, let's do it. So we hop into the Baltic Sea, and ever since then, I've been just kind of addicted to the whole polar bear swim thing. I try to hop in my pool as often as possible in the wintertime.
Oh yeah, that cold plunge thing is money. It's legit. Money. But you are so, and this is what makes me kind of a crappy pastor in a lot of ways, is that, man, I want to care. I really do want to care, but it's a stretch. It's a stretch to put me in the room with the dying. It's a stretch to get me in that place with a bad diagnosis and be like, because what I want to instantly do is go to that place and be like, well, the upside is.
It's like, I'm the jerk that goes in and makes a joke when somebody's dying.
Every time. Yeah, like, hey, tell the Lord I said, hey. I'm like, what is
it? Yeah, exactly. You can't say that. I did, though. But it takes all types, man. You know, that your personality type may not be great for that part of pastoring, but it's going to be great for other parts of pastoring. Yeah. You got some deacons who are better in that sense.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I find myself in that place. And as far as the Enneagram goes, I mean, that fits the seven, right? I mean, I'm a little bit of an Enneagram junkie. Are you really? Oh gosh, yeah.
Most everybody's like, Enneagram is the cult. And I get tired of those. By the way, speaking of that, bridging it back to the movie, and I know you got to go, but I ran into that kind of Christian snobbery with small group. There was a big group of people who would protest the movie and tell everybody not to watch it because some of the characters did yoga, and yoga is of the occult. Now,
it happened.
I'll say this. My wife told me when she read the script, she's like, You probably ought to rethink the yoga thing. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, there's a bunch of people who are going to – she follows all these ladies who are, you know, super popular. And she's like, yeah, there's these one ladies. And people are going to come out and say that this is not right because yoga is of the occult. Yoga is – I was like, no, I won't. And oh, my gosh, did they. And my thought, I didn't know. I thought yoga was just stretching and core work. I really did. I thought that's all it was. And some – spiritual, whatever. I never thought of it as dangerous. Yeah, so forgive me for being ignorant. I just knew that the lady coming from LA, the liberal from LA with her filmmaker husband, what's she going to come here and do? She's going to probably start a yoga studio. Seemed natural to me. So that got me a lot. But I always tell people, look, if we want to complain about Christmas, that Christmas at one point stood for one thing, the birth of Christ. And it went from there, and it got over, like, sanitized to a secular level in a secular society, and now it's Santa Claus and Christmas presents, and it doesn't mean what it once did. So my question is this: if you take an atheist and they participate in Christian practices, or not Christian practice, they participate in Christmas practices by doing Santa Claus and, you know, shopping or whatever, they participate in the secular parts of it with zero connection to the spiritual part of it.
Right.
Do they get God credits for that? Does God think, well, I know you don't believe in the original thing, but because you're doing it, you're with us. Or are they doing something totally different? Well, right. They're doing something totally different. Yeah. So the same thing with yoga for me is like, so if someone uses yoga to bend and stretch and work on their core, and they have no idea that even relates to anything, any kind of roots of Eastern mysticism,
right.
Why are they still drugged down by Eastern mysticism when the person celebrating Christmas has with no relation to the original spiritual intent?
That's a good point.
They're not picked up from it.
Yeah,
so
it's a fair question. Yeah,
it's a fair question.
Yeah.
It's the Christian cancel culture will get you. Woo,
yeah, it's what my buddy calls the bully cult.
Yeah, the bully cult will get you. And the same thing with Enneagram. My wife loves it. What my wife says is, look, I mean, is it a pentagram? Is it satanic? I don't know. What she'll say is, like, I don't use it to excuse my own sin.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people say is, you use it to excuse your own sin. No, I don't. And in fact, it's the opposite of that. I use it to recognize my own sin so that I can work on that. But more, it's a tool of grace. If I know this person is a three, and when they're in their unhealthy spot, that three is going to be like, look at me, I'm the greatest. And you have to go, oh, okay, that's just part of her personality.
Yeah.
Love her to death.
Yeah.
Satan the Southern, bless her heart. But
yeah.
We know that that's her personality tendency. We all have sin tendencies, and we don't all tend towards the same sin. And you know that from something as simple as the prodigal son story, right? The prodigal son story is a story of two polar opposite types of sin. There's the sins of the world and how people went out, or that the younger brother went out and went to the sins of the world, and we learned this father opened his arms. Mm-hmm. But it's also about that big brother, the pious guy who did everything right. Mm-hmm. And he looks down on the little brother and he says, Father, why is that guy as good as me? I've earned all this, right? Mm-hmm. And the father's like, that ain't how it works, buddy. Mm-hmm. So I think in Christian culture, a lot of times we tend to look down our nose at the little brothers, while ignoring the sins of the big brothers.
Yeah.
But everybody has very different sin tendencies. I tend to think that the little brothers tell better stories and make better pastors than the big brothers. Who's a 45-year-old man who found Jesus when he was 35, but before that he was, you know, smoking dope and in a biker gang. I'm going to learn more from that guy than from this guy who's been pious all his life.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. The Enneagram has shown me over and over and over. When you say it's a tool for grace, that's exactly, I can't tell you how many people I've met who are Enneagram fours. And when I find that out, I go, okay. It's
you're
not
inside your own head.
Yeah. Oh, you're not though. Okay. You used to be just a weirdo. I don't know. There's something more going on. Like you're in a constant melancholy battle. Like that's kind of a, like that's kind
or you're of you're a nine who can't make a dadgum decision to save your life. And I want to strangle you less because I understand that about you.
That's right. Oh, or how about this one? And from the standpoint of a couple of Enneagram sevens talking about it, I heard a buddy of mine say the other day, he's like, you know, but you got to remember, Jared, there's some people in the world who they don't want anything. And I go, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Who, you want nothing? It's dangerous to want things. Well, so what do you do if you're me and you want everything? I want everything. I just want all of it. He's like, well, some people aren't like, I can't.
I can't understand those people.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
So, I hear you, brother.
Matt, thank you so much for this. This is a great conversation. It'll be
thank you for having me on.
Be a great episode.
I'd
love to get with you again sometime.
I'm right anytime you are, brother.
All right, man. Well, I'll let you do your thing. And again, the film is incredible.
Thank you.
Forward to the new stuff that's coming out. I'd love to get
go
an
watch
update
Small
on
Group. You can get us at smallgroupmovie.net, I think. Small.com. I don't know. Look up a Small Group Movie. You'll find it. It's on all the platforms. I would encourage you to try, if you can buy a physical copy from our website, do that. It's fine to go rent it on Amazon. It's just then Jeff Bezos gets half instead of my investors. I get none, but the investors get some. So that's
we should come back and talk about that sometime.
I could do another 3 hours on that topic alone.
I appreciate you, and I'll get with you soon.